The Pope made climate change a moral issue, and now people in Appalachia are talking with their local churches about coal and natural gas.
Their stories indicate that people have little say over the impact these industries will have over their everyday lives.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, an open letter from the church about what the changing energy landscape means to the people of Appalachia. Also, how farmers are wrestling with a force outside of their control, climate change. And a genetically modified pork chop on your plate in just 5 years?
Yeah, or maybe we're being optimistic.
Maybe. We'll find out. That's all coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. This week, the Supreme Court stunned the Environmental Protection Agency by freezing its signature plan to reduce carbon emissions from coal-fired power plants. The decision, 5-4, along party lines, granted the coal industry and 29 states and state agencies a stay on complying with the Clean Power Plan while the plan undergoes judicial review. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey was the lead litigator. He says the plan was an overreach by the Obama administration.
This is a monumental victory for West Virginia, the country, and the rule of law. But most importantly, this Supreme Court decision is a win for coal miners and their families.
Here to talk about the decision and what it means is Reed Frazier, our energy reporter. Hi, Reed.
Hey, Kara.
So what exactly did the Supreme Court decide this week?
I'll just back up and explain what the Clean Power Plan is really quickly. It's kind of the heart of the Obama administration's plan to do something about climate change. Coal-fired power plants are the biggest source of carbon dioxide in the United States, and this plan was aimed at limiting the emissions of carbon from that sector. So a bunch of energy states and energy companies asked the Supreme Court to basically just put a hold on the plan while the plan works its way through the courts and eventually the Supreme Court. The courts never granted this kind of stay, and this time, to many people's surprise, it did.
How has this decision been received?
It's basically been a shock to almost everyone who has been following this case. Environmentalists and the industry were both kind of taken by surprise by the ruling, and that's because Supreme Court's been around a long time, and it's never done this. It's never just said, hey, you got to stop. We're going to wait and see if this rule is legal before you are allowed to go ahead and do it. It's always let the agencies proceed. And I spoke to Scott Osteich. He's an attorney for Murray Energy, one of the plaintiffs on the case. And this is what he said about his reaction to the decision. Scale of 1 to 10, how shocked were you?
9, because the horse handicappers had said that the Supreme Court has never done this before. That's a pretty good indication that the Supreme Court won't do this. So they've opened up a completely new role for the court that has heretofore never once been invoked.
Why is this decision important in coal-producing states like West Virginia?
Well, what it does immediately for them is it allows them to basically ignore the rule for the next 18 months to 2 years while it works its way through the courts. And essentially, they don't have to make any plans to cut carbon, and they can kind of proceed in a business-as-usual manner the way they are now. In fact, Kentucky, which was in the middle of making a plan to comply with the Clean Power Plan, just announced that they aren't going to do it. They're not going to make a plan, and they're going to wait it out and see what the Supreme Court says.
What about Pennsylvania?
Well, Pennsylvania, Governor Tom Wolf is a Democrat. He supports the Clean Power Plan, and Pennsylvania is going to go ahead and keep writing a plan. But eventually, they're probably going to have to hit pause on their plan because, the Supreme Court won't decide this for a while.
So does this decision mean that the Supreme Court is willing to overturn the Clean Power Plan?
That's a really important and central question that has come up. And basically, the answer is yeah. The Supreme Court, one of the hurdles they have to meet in issuing a stay on a rule like this is they have to decide, does it look likely that this rule will be deemed illegal? Does it look likely that the appellants, in this case, states like West Virginia and energy companies, have a good case? And the five justices who sided with those states and those companies are basically saying, yeah, they have a pretty good case here. So it's a bad omen, no matter how you slice it, for the EPA. Now, the Obama administration has said, well, this is a bump in the road. We're pretty confident that we'll win on the merits of the case. But anybody who's looking at this has to look at this as bad news for the rule in the long run.
What about the commitments that President Obama made to cutting carbon emissions at the UN climate talks in Paris? How does this decision affect those commitments?
It could affect it an awful lot. The Clean Power Plan is the main mechanism that the U.S. was going to use to achieve its climate goals that it set for itself in Paris. I spoke with Ann Carlson. She is a law professor at the UCLA School of Law who's been following the case. And she says this definitely has implications beyond the U.S.
Basically, what the court just did is took out the heart of the United States plan that is, again, part of this global agreement. And it sends a signal to the rest of the world that the United States cannot live up to its commitment if this rule is going to be struck down.
Carlson said there's a pretty good chance that this case goes against the EPA. And if it does, then the next administration, be they Republican or Democrat, if they choose to address climate change, they're probably going to have to reassess what role the EPA can play in making that happen.
When will the Supreme Court rule on this? What are the next steps?
Well, the case is kind of getting fast-tracked through the appellate court. So their D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals is going to hear the case this summer. And the fastest that the Supreme Court could hear an argument would be next fall. That would be the fall of 2017. So we're talking a good 18 months before a decision, maybe 2 years, something like that. So it's going to be a while.
Well, thanks very much, Reed.
Thank you.
Reed Frazier is the Allegheny Front's energy reporter. For more about the Supreme Court's decision to put the Clean Power Plan on hold, check out our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Despite this week's court victory, coal country is grappling with a long-term decline of the industry and the implications of that, the loss of jobs, its legacy on the land, and what comes next. The Catholic Committee of Appalachia recently published a pastoral letter, the third of its kind. 40 years ago, the first was called one of the most significant statements to emerge from the U.S. Catholic Church. West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board reports this open letter is infused with environmental themes.
When the story of these mountains as resource takes over the story of the mountains as home, we become homeless in our own place and disconnected from Earth and one another. These are some of the opening lines from The Telling Takes Us Home, taking our place in the stories that shape us. That's the title of the new pastoral letter released from the Catholic Committee of Appalachia. The committee, a network of faith-based people, is focused on addressing social justice issues of Appalachia. The lead author of the letter is Michael Iafrate, a resident of Wheeling, West Virginia, completing a doctorate in theology.
The pastoral itself is a telling of the story of Appalachia and the people that are here and all of our diversity. And it's a telling of the church at the grassroots that's committed to justice, which is often a contrary voice in larger church contexts.
For over 4 years, Iafrate and other committee members organized listening sessions with religious and non-religious throughout Appalachia. The resulting missive is 60 pages written in an open verse poetic form with themes similar to many of the recent messages from Pope Francis. The pontiff has been preaching about moral obligations to care for the earth and the wisdom that can be learned from marginalized populations most affected by ecological devastation. The pastoral highlights voices of coal miners as one such marginalized group. Iafrate recalls meeting union and non-union miners in a cafe in north central West Virginia. He says common concerns were over mine safety and a lack of economic diversity.
We heard the idea that, you know, they're willing, able to do other types of work, but there's nothing else, which suggests to me, you know, this opening that we're seeing in other parts of the country with alternative energies, sustainable energies. And this is the kind of thing that I think the church can be speaking out about. Of course, the church can be present mourning with communities that are suffering from loss of jobs and without a loss of meaning, perhaps. But also the church can be helping to point toward other possibilities.
Iafrate also remembers listening to a Catholic farmer, Ron Gula, from Hickory, Pennsylvania. Gula signed a gas lease in 2002, and after witnessing destruction to his property and fighting with industry and state officials over the years, he became a vocal opponent of fracking.
I visited his home and sat on his back porch at a picnic table, and I think I was there for 3 or 4 hours listening to stories from his own experience and other farmers in that area. It was very emotionally moving to hear what he's been dealing with for the last several years, but how that's empowered him to be really a leader in this movement.
Iafrate says many more listening sessions revealed shared frustrations over dynamics between industry and community. He says communities are recognizing abusive patterns coming from the gas industry that are similar to those experienced for decades from the coal industry.
I mean, as the pastoral itself says, many people impacted by fracking cannot help but think that this is but a new chapter in the same old story of resource extraction in Appalachia, where industry, assisted by politicians, exerts control over resources, land, even whole communities. Their stories indicate that people have little say over the impact these industries will have over their everyday lives.
The pastoral letter is also studded with paintings of mountains that have been surface mined.
We wanted the design and the artwork to be part of the message itself.
Iafrate reconnected with an old Catholic friend and painter, Parkersburg, West Virginia native Christopher Santer.
We just thought that the paintings really expressed very well the a lot of the messages that the pastoral was talking about. The sense of home, the sense of telling the story of the mountains and of the people who live here. And it was just a striking visual way of saying something prophetic about where we're from and what we think about where we're from.
Iafrate says a lot of different people are trying to tell a new story of what it means to be Appalachian these days. He says the pastoral is a way for people of faith to join that chorus. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Glynis Board.
Yes, I live in a coal mining town. The people there are friendly, but the men, they must go down. A mile or two just to try and make it.
Americans love bacon. And let's face it, lots of other delicious products that come from pigs. But pigs are susceptible to a nasty virus.
It causes a lot of coughing and the pigs get very sick.
One solution? Breeding virus-resistant pigs.
They'll introduce the edit into their genetic lines.
Coming up later on the Allegheny Front, this little piggy went to market and this little piggy had its genes altered. Are you ready? Stay tuned. Farmers and ranchers have always been at the whim of the weather. That's gotten more intense as the climate changes, from the drought out west to unpredictable weather and seasons here in the east. The Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, or PASA, even themed its 25th annual conference around the issue. Organic and sustainable farmers gathered at State College, Pennsylvania, to discuss practical ways to keep their farms in business while protecting the environment and weathering the changes out there. Ryan Snyder, executive director of PASA, says adjusting to climate change is a big deal for farmers.
I think, in fact, in the years ahead, farmers are going to play a big role in fighting climate change.
He says their fields can sequester carbon, and they've got the real estate to harvest wind and solar energy. The busy halls of the conference center are lined with booths.
It smells amazing here. What am I smelling?
You're smelling sage, you're smelling rosemary.
Candy Traven from Peachtree Farm near Doylestown is selling little potted herbs from her family's greenhouse. She's been farming since 1983, but this year's been different.
This is so bizarre where we can get 50 degrees 1 week and 3 feet of snow the next. Even just thinking about it, I'm running chills, you know, when you see the change and what's going on.
And she sees more changes coming.
The greenhouse is a it's a separate environment that we've created. And I think more and more we'll have to be growing like in high tunnels or greenhouses, you know, creating our own environments because we can't deal with the one we have.
I find Adam Dusen waiting for a talk on pest management for fruit trees. He recently started a 10-acre fruit operation in New Hope, Pennsylvania.
We're going to do like apples and pears and cherries.
Dusen says climate change scares him, but warming temperatures could also help him grow things like pomegranates and figs in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, it wouldn't be such a bad thing to be able to grow some things that we wouldn't normally be able to grow.
How these and other farmers will adapt to climate change is the passion of Laura Lennick, a keynote speaker at the conference. She's a longtime sustainable agriculture expert and author of the book Resilient Agriculture, Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate. I had a chance to sit down with her and talk about her vision for the future of American farming. My first question, what is resilient agriculture?
Resilient agriculture is an agriculture that has the capacity to respond to climate disturbances in a way that helps the farm system or the food system avoid damage, recover quickly from damage. And then there's a part to resilient agriculture that is about transformation, about recognizing when you need to change a system because it's no longer serving you well in the new conditions under a changing climate.
You write in your book that we've done this before, the agriculture about 10,000 years ago, we sort of went through this major climate shift and had to adapt as human beings. Things haven't really changed all that much since then, and I just wanted you to talk a little bit about that.
We've got this great story about how we invented agriculture, and then life became wonderful. Because of agriculture, we developed civilization, the arts, writing, all of the wonderful things that define us as human beings. And I think what I learned in all of that was that agriculture itself, this transition of our species from foragers to farmers, was spurred by climate change. Then I started thinking about the possibility that we could actually use the disturbance of climate change to transform our food system in ways that address the harms of our existing system. So we could actually bounce forward as a result of climate change into a better way of eating.
Your eyes are kind of lit up when you were talking about that discovery. So what excites you about that? What would that look like?
We have a food system in this country that is fairly vulnerable to climate change, that is dependent quite a bit on imports, that is dependent on one state for a large portion of its fruits, nuts, and vegetables. And that state is going through a pretty incredible drought.
That state is California.
So that's one example of the way that we are vulnerable to climate change. Long transport and supply chains and monoculture. We grow much of our food in monoculture, and those are also examples of resilience challenges in our food system. Where I think we could go, and where I think the research in the book provides good examples of this, is to a more sustainable food system. To improve the climate resilience of the U.S. food system, we would need to do two things. And they're not small things, but we're completely capable of doing them. The first is we need to restructure the agriculture system. Rather than depending on global supplies of food and California, we need to move food production closer to metropolitan areas around the country. And the second thing we need to do is diversify agriculture. Place agriculture mixed with forest lands, wild lands, in a patchwork around our metropolitan areas. And both of those things together have been called a metropolitan food shed. And there's been a lot of work to suggest that this would actually provide climate resilience benefits, as well as a whole host of other benefits, public health benefits, nutrition benefits, address a lot of the harms that right now we're experiencing with the industrial food system.
You talked with 25 sustainable producers from all over the country for your book, some here from our region. Can you tell me about one of those farmers, how they're managing a change in climate and what strategies they're using?
Elizabeth Henderson. She's a vegetable farmer farming in Newark, New York. And she has been farming on the specific farm about 20 years and in the area about 30 years. The quote that I think captures what she had to share with me about the changes she's seen in climate really well is her quote, "You have to be so nimble these days." And what she's referring to is she has seen in the last decade or so just a large increase in more variable weather, heavier rainfalls, more frequent drought, heat wave to the point that she's concerned about her field workers and herself. She's added irrigation, something she never needed prior to the last 5 years or so. Because rainfall is coming in fewer and heavier downfalls, and there's longer periods of drought, she really needed to have the ability to irrigate her crops.
How can consumers participate in resilient agriculture?
As much as possible, eat from farmers who are growing using sustainable methods. Do what you can to support local farmers. Another step you can take is grow a little bit of food yourself if you can. Even if it's just on the balcony of your apartment, put a pot out there, grow some lettuce or something. One of the key aspects of a resilient system is diversity.
To encourage diversity, you mean like instead of buying just broccoli, we buy some kind of other vegetable we haven't heard of? Or
that's a great example. Yeah, I was thinking more about diversity of farm type so that you're spreading your dollars out. Let's say you're someone who goes to a farmer's market already. You might want to spread your dollars out among the different farms, but you bring up a great point. If we eat more diversity, then we are promoting diversity on the farm as well. So that's a great idea.
In the acknowledgments section of your book, you thank the farmers and growers talking about their experiences of farming in a changing climate at a time when it was still a bit risky to do so. That's a quote from your book. What did you mean by that? And are people still reticent to talk about climate change?
Maybe in the last 3 years. I really noticed the difference from when I first started this research to now. And the reason I wanted to include that acknowledgement of the farmers that are in the book is I made over 600 separate inquiries to try to find farmers to be included in this project. A significant number of them wrote me to say, thank you for doing this. It needs to be done, but I am not comfortable going on record right now in my community that I believe in climate change, that I believe it's happening. And I think that's a clear indication of how politicized climate change was and still is. But at the time that these farmers agreed to be interviewed for the book, it was a little bit risky. And I think they were really courageous to agree to be involved in the project.
Why has it changed?
I get asked that a lot. And you know, all I can do is give you my own perception of why it's changed. And the things that I notice, the language that's been used in the Obama administration in the last 4 years or so. The national conversation moved from whether or not it was happening and who was right and into a more, I think, productive conversation, which is, it's happening, what do we do about it? And that gives people hope. And in the minute you have some hope, I think, you're more willing and open to talk about an issue or a challenge.
Laura Lenick is the author of Resilient Agriculture, Cultivating Food Systems for a Changing Climate. We spoke at PASA's Farming for the Future conference. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Another twist on modern agriculture. Humans have been breeding animals for millennia, but now genetically engineered animals could be coming to your dinner plate soon. As Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports, regulators are currently grappling with the new technology.
Tucked away in a University of Missouri research building is a family of pigs. Two new litters joined the family 4 days ago. Melissa Samuel takes care of the whole group. They range from 4 days old to about a year and a half. They're pudgy and pink.
I think they're pretty happy pigs, though. They're pretty easy to work with. They do what we want them to do. They seem happy, like their back scratched every now and then.
The goal is to have farmers raise pigs like these for your ham hocks and pork butts. But they're not raised in hog barns just yet. That's because these little piggies are special.
These pigs have been modified so that they are resistant to the PRRS, the porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome virus.
These are genetically engineered pigs. The porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome virus, or PRRS, first popped up in the 1980s. Kristen Whitworth is a research scientist at the University of Missouri who helped develop these virus-resistant pigs. She says the virus costs the U.S. pork industry more than $660 million a year.
It's a devastating disease. It causes persistent infection. It causes abortions in pigs, so they'll lose their litters. It causes a lot of coughing, and the pigs get very sick.
Once the virus enters a pig, it spreads with the help of a protein. Whitworth and her team genetically edited the gene that makes this protein, effectively removing it.
And once that molecule is no longer present, then the virus cannot only get inside the macrophages, but cannot spread from pig to pig.
This is big news for livestock producers. If a pig is infected, a farmer typically has to euthanize the whole barn, Whitworth says. It's financially and emotionally devastating. Researchers from the University of Missouri and Kansas State University developed the PRRS-resistant pig with funding from their universities and the company that ultimately owns the rights to the research. They announced their findings in December. Whitworth says they hope to have the pigs to market in 5 years.
Yeah, and maybe we're being optimistic. But.
Well, scientists tend to be optimistic, right? I mean, that's you're in science to try to solve problems.
Allison Van Inenum is an animal biotechnology and genomics specialist at the University of California, Davis. She says it's challenging to get animals that have been genetically modified approved by the Food and Drug Administration. There is just one approved animal out there, a salmon that has been genetically modified to grow twice as fast as wild salmon.
Up until this point, even though the technology was developed, you know, more than 30 years ago, that's the only thing that's ever got through regulatory, and it took about 20 years and tens of millions of dollars to get it through.
The FDA won't allow sales of the fish stateside until it finishes its labeling guidelines, a process which could take additional years. There are other genetically engineered animals in the works. Hornless cattle, hypoallergenic cows, pigs resistant to African swine fever. So why aren't more genetically engineered animals in stores? Two big reasons. One, Van Inenum says the technology is still relatively new, so the FDA has a lot of questions.
The animal breeding community is kind of looking to see, well, what is going to be the response of regulators to this technology?
And two, there is no one-size-fits-all study. Each animal and genetic modification is different. Kevin Wells is an assistant professor at the University of Missouri who worked with the PRRS-resistant pigs and sat on the Federal Advisory Committee on the Super Salmon.
For example, if you're introducing a brand new protein that perhaps humans don't typically eat, is that something that we're allergic to? Whereas you wouldn't have to necessarily ask that question of something that we eat every day.
Then there are worries about consumer response. The FDA also needs to sort out if and how the products derived from genetically engineered animals will be labeled. When it comes to the PRRS-resistant pigs, researcher Kristen Whitworth says Genus, the company that purchased the technology, will do the hoop jumping for federal approval.
They will look at feed efficiency and growth, and they'll introduce the edit into their genetic lines.
If that happens, it won't be long before they're in grocery stores across the country. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
That story came to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting collaboration focusing on agriculture and food production. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer. I'm Carol Holsapple. Join us again here next time, or find us online on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports coverage of energy and conservation.